Hello and welcome to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia El-Khoury.
And good evening, everyone. I am Seema Barker and delighted to be here. And we are going to start off with a follow-up on last week's show. If you were able to tune in or if you heard it on the podcast, do remember that we do podcasts of our show, then you will know that we were talking about the vaccination to 12 to 15-year-olds. And in fact, we were delighted to have three 12 to 15 year olds talking to us about how they felt. And our follow up is, well, Lydia, why don't you tell us about the guests that we are going to be talking to first of all?
Sure, Seema. So we had those three local students, really articulate, bright, you know, so impressive, talking about the vaccine. And I felt like at the end of the show, I think Seema, you and I agreed that we really felt we wanted a medical voice on this. So we've invited Dr. Alison Cowan to join us on the show this evening and talk to us so we can put all those parenty questions that we all want to ask straight to Alison and get the facts straight from her. So Alison, thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show this evening.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me along.
So Alison, tell us a little bit about your role and in particular your local role.
Sure. So I'm a local GP. I work across a couple of surgeries, one over Hemelway and one in St Albans, and also within the Young Person Service, which is currently held at Parkbury House Surgery in St Albans. And at the start of the vaccination rollout, I was helping in the vaccine hub, the GP vaccine hub at Batchwood. But latterly, I've been more just concentrating on general surgeries. There's loads of help, plenty of help in the vaccine hubs, the remaining ones, and obviously the government-run ones. But still have to keep up to speed with all the latest information, just to advise patients coming through with questions, etc.
And I believe, Alison, you're more than just a professional kind of perspective on this, because you've also got the personal perspective on the kind of younger people getting the vaccination.
Absolutely, yeah. I've got three teenage daughters, although I can't say teenage for too much longer, as my oldest turns 20 next year. But they're all at different stages of the vaccine process. So my oldest has been double vaccinated. My 18-year-old has had one vaccine and is just about to have her second. And my 15-year-old is about to have her first vaccine through the school vaccine program next week. So we're very big proponents of it.
Right, yeah. So, and that's really helpful to us, actually, because it's great to have your professional opinion, but also, you know, your own experience as well is fantastic. And it's really, you know, helpful to be able to put these questions to you. And I suppose we can start with, well, probably the first fundamental question is, what would you say about the risks that are involved with younger people getting the vaccine?
Yeah, sure. So the risks of the vaccine are very, very small, but the challenge is the risk of getting COVID in the younger population is also quite small, which makes that risk-benefit balance a little bit harder to discern. Luckily, we have some excellent regulatory bodies who've reviewed all the available data, and our chief medical officers have advised that the overall benefit, when you take all of that into consideration, is in favour of the vaccine. And that view takes into account the marginal advantage on an individual level, but also the bigger public health advantage from reducing educational disruption as well. So they've calculated that vaccinating that age group will result in 100,000 fewer days of school loss over the next 6 months, which obviously has a big public health impact, but also on the individual level means that, you know, kids can continue to attend school, see their peers and see their friends, and don't miss out on that aspect of things as well.
Absolutely. So there's one very, very solid reason for going with the vaccine for 12 to 15 year olds, 100,000 days of school. And we all know the children have missed so much school time as it is. So that's one compelling argument. What else would you say to parents? I mean, parents like us are not anti-vaccination. We're certainly not reluctant to get the vaccine, but I think there is a slight hesitancy around it just because parents are trying to weigh up whether they actually need to. So you've said days missed from school, that's extremely important. What other reasons are there for parents out there to, you know, get their children vaccinated, their 12 to 15 year olds vaccinated?
Sure. Well, even though if you were to get COVID, and as many youngsters have found, the illness itself isn't likely to be serious or result in hospitalisation, it's still not great being unwell when you have a virus of any description. So being able to avoid that, hopefully through vaccination, or certainly reduce the likelihood, is definitely a good thing. But also the longer impact. So we know that 2 to 14% of children and young people will have persisting symptoms or post-COVID syndromes. And that's a significant percentage that hopefully, obviously, through having your children vaccinated, the risk of that will be reduced.
So, of course, avoiding long COVID at all costs, it only makes sense. And I'm double vaccinated, but caught COVID a couple of months after I was vaccinated and had a pretty rough time with it. So I can say I'm personally one person who would, I was so glad I was vaccinated, because I can only imagine how much worse it would have been had I not had the vaccination. Mm. So it's kind of unpredictable how badly you're going to get it, but you certainly don't want your teenagers to experience that kind of it, because it is a nasty virus.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So anything that reduces that risk has got to be a good thing, especially when the risks of the vaccine itself are so low.
Alison, what about people's hesitancy around how quickly the vaccination was developed? Can you just tell us how you would respond if somebody was to ask you about that?
Yeah, so all the vaccines were subjected to 3 stages of clinical trials, but as opposed to them being done in succession, they were all run in parallel, which is why it seemed to take a lot less time. And I know that there's a lot more information and even some videos, I believe, on the government website concerning that as well, because I know it is a big concern that's been expressed. So the information on the government website for parents has some videos attached to that to explain in a little bit more depth, or reassure a little bit more depth, how the vaccines are developed so quickly. But they were still obviously rigorously tested across those 3 stages of clinical trials. And, to millions of people in the UK and across a broad range of, across the world and across a broad range of groups.
And Alison, we hear, there's so many different rumours out there and Chinese whispers and unfortunately crazy conspiracy theories around the vaccine. But one little rumour that seems to be spreading around is about fertility being affected by the vaccine. Is there any truth in that? Is it because COVID affects fertility, or does the vaccine affect fertility? What's the data showing?
Yeah, so what the data has shown that there is absolutely no evidence at all that the vaccine affects fertility, and that's been across a number of different groups. And, even unintentional pregnancies, they're able to look at the data and see that there was no difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. Similarly, there have been some reports of menstrual changes or changes in periods, and they've looked very closely at that data to see if there's any significant link with the vaccine. And so far, they haven't found that. A number of things can change your periods, from something as simple as stress to any form of illness. And they haven't yet found a link with the vaccine itself, but they're still collecting that data and reviewing it so that they can make sure they are giving the right information around that, and recognise that something like menstrual irregularities can be a concern to the general public. So it's always important, perhaps, from the outset to mention, the absence of evidence in favour of that, but reassure people that obviously these sorts of effects are, monitored anyway and very short-lived. So it's reassuring to know that all of this sort of data and menstrual changes, etc., is continuously reviewed. But at the moment, there's absolutely no link found between the vaccine and menstrual changes, or in particular, infertility.
Yes, I understood. I'd heard of a study that they'd done in fertility clinics where they had administered placebos. And, by doing that research, they'd found no link there either in relation to fertility. So that's all reassuring. I mean, everything on that front seems to be incredibly reassuring. Would you agree, Alison?
Yeah, absolutely. The evidence is or lack of evidence is very clear with respect to fertility. Absolutely. But yeah, exactly. And it's always good to know that there is those that monitoring that's going on in the background with anything anyway. But yeah, very reassuring that there's no link found.
And I suppose one of the things about this, actually, talking about rumours, but also talking about, you know, ourselves, all becomes like, you know, Chinese whisper scientists since the pandemic started. You know, what our understanding is, how we process all of the information. Of course, that's part of the problem, perhaps, is that there is so much information out there. We want to make the best decisions for ourselves, for our children, and for our society. Can you talk to us about that? Like, why kind of getting the vaccine, if kids didn't get the vaccine, would it affect it kind of the effectiveness of the vaccine against the virus itself in society?
No, absolutely. Because whilst the virus is able to circulate and transmit and cause infection, you know, whilst it's sort of flourishing, if you like, in the population without, you know, anything fighting against it, then it can start to adapt. And that's where you can start to get the variants that we're seeing. So the longer the virus is able to circulate and transmit, the higher that risk of variants developing becomes. And therefore, any vaccine made against one particular variant, you know, there's always a risk may become less effective, which is why it's so important that, you know, that a good percentage of the, well, everybody possible can have the vaccine and fight against that virus, reduce its chance of being able to circulate in the population and evolve to continue to do that.
You really make such a compelling case for getting the vaccination, Alison. You know, avoiding long COVID, stopping the virus circulating, missing school days. I mean, just this week, all the school open days are not all of them, but some of a selection of open days are on. And Stags have had to cancel theirs because of an outbreak of COVID. So I suppose in the longer term, to have a normal life again, where you can plan an open day and follow through with it, the key is getting young people vaccinated, because it's, even if the effect is not terrible on them or as deadly as it is for, say, over 50s, it still has an impact.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd say my youngest actually had COVID end of June, and the 10-day isolation, I think, for her was a much greater impact probably than if she were to get COVID itself. So those 10 days were very long and very hard for her. And I think obviously she had COVID, but I think the impact of being away from her friends is far greater than the actual virus itself. So yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree. Minimising that risk is so important to them as well.
Fantastic. And just to wrap it up, I mean, we really get a feeling, you know, that we're in safe hands. You know, you've looked at the data, you know what you're talking about, and you're advising us. And professionally, what would you say about how the rollout is going to young people, and any other thoughts that you want to share with parents?
I think it does seem that there's a lot of really good information out there. And as a result, I know a good percentage of parents do, you know, are suggesting, or surveys show are suggesting, that they are keen for their children to be vaccinated. And similarly, children themselves, when surveyed, are very positive about it. So I think the right message is getting out there. And I think it is the right step to try and get on top of this and put this last couple of years behind us. There's some excellent, really excellent information available on the website covid.healthierfuture.org.uk, which contains a lot of this information, but also how the rollout's going, you know, where you can access the vaccines across all sorts of different age groups. So I think it's a really important step, and I think it is important that people feel well informed and reassured. And I think this website in particular does that very well. So I'd encourage listeners to have a look at that. In addition,
would you mind just reminding us of the name of it again,
please,
Alison?
It's covid.healthierfuture.org.uk. But if you put in the search engine COVID and healthier future, it should come up. But it's covid.healthierfuture.org.uk.
And I think you've just hit a lovely positive note to wind up the interview. Yeah, we all want a healthier future, and nobody wants another winter lockdown like we had last year. Brilliant. Dr. Alison Cowan, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia El-Khoury.
And I am Seema Barker, and we are delighted to be with you. And we've got something very different this evening.
Yeah, so we're kind of getting stuck into the idea of training to be a lawyer and what different paths you can take. And I think this will be really interesting for parents of children who are either doing GCSE, A-level, or in fact, who have done their first degree. So I'm really pleased to be joined by Jessica Smith, who joined Raiden Solicitors as a trainee solicitor in September 2019 and qualified as a solicitor in March of this year, 2021. Jessica, a warm welcome to The Parents Show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's lovely to have you on. And I'd really like to hear a little bit more about yourself. Tell us about yourself.
Of course. So I am a solicitor currently practicing at Raiden Solicitors. I am based in the St Albans office and I practice all areas of family law. So that covers sort of divorce, finances, children, disputes, adoption, prenuptial agreements, everything that you can think of that is under the umbrella of family law. So I currently live in Bedford and I commute to work. I'm doing a couple of days in the office and a couple of days at home every week. Yeah, that's me.
Fantastic. And tell us, Jessica, I mean, tell us how you got to be a solicitor. What route did you take? Was it the normal route?
Yes, so I took the traditional route to qualification. So that consisted of lots of different stages of sort of education and then gaining work experience. So I firstly did an undergraduate degree. I did that in business management at Leeds University. So that meant that after I'd finished my degree, I had to do what's known as a graduate diploma in law, which is known as the law conversion. And that's because I didn't do a law degree at university. So just to clarify, you don't have to do a law degree to become a lawyer. But in the current way that I qualified, it meant that I had to do an additional year of training to basically give me the legal knowledge that I needed to be a lawyer. So once I'd completed that, I then went on to do a practice course, which is basically all of the skills that you would need to be a lawyer. That's an additional year of training. And then I went on to do my 2-year training contract. I did it at Raiden Solicitors, but you can, most law firms do offer training contracts. And within that 2 years, you have to do 12 additional days of training, which is known as a professional skills course. So overall, I did 3 years at uni, 1 year of the GDL, 1 year of the LPC, and then a 2-year training contract. So it's quite a long period to qualify. That obviously is now changing because there's now, as of September 2021, so now the Solicitors Regulation Authority has introduced a new route to qualification, which now anyone going through the process of wanting to become a lawyer, that is the process that they will go through going forward.
So that is, there's a lot there. So let's see if we can break this down a little bit. So actually your degree is your degree, mm-hmm. and anybody can go and do that. They can do a law degree, but if they don't do a law degree, as you didn't, you are able to essentially convert. So get those basic legal knowledge that you need. And that was that first postgraduate course that you did. And then after that, you did the legal practice course. Is that still what it's called? And you did the legal practice course. And that gives you all the practical skills of being a lawyer. And so that was a year. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Fantastic. And then after that, and I'd just like to ask you about this bit in a bit more detail, because some people just might not have this kind of knowledge. But when you did your 2 years, and it's called a training contract, so that means you're employed at a solicitor's firm and you were with Raiden's, you're employed at a solicitor's firm, but you're not just doing family law then. So can you just explain that for our parents or young people that are listening and interested in a potential career in law?
Yeah, so the training contract, a traditional training contract is 2 years long. and you would do four different seats, so basically four different areas of law within that 2 years. And usually that would be 6 months in each different area of law. And obviously it depends what your law firm offers in terms of which area that you will, areas that you will do for your training contract. And for most people, it's really useful because it means that they have an opportunity to get experience and in four different areas. And then at the end, if it helps them to choose what they want to do long term, because ultimately a lot of people, when they join a law firm and they start their training contract, they won't know which area of law that they actually want to specialize in. So that's the sort of purpose of a training contract, is that you get this wide experience in different areas of law, and then you can choose at the end where you want to qualify.
Yeah, no, that sounds fantastic, actually. And so you obviously, and then you, while you were doing your training contract, I suppose explaining what that means, you're actually working. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It is a qualification, but you're actually there meeting clients.
Yeah, you're employed by the firm and you're carrying out legal work, obviously under supervision because you're not yet qualified, but you're meeting clients, you're drafting documents, you are going to court, you're going to meetings with clients and other experts. Most firms will have a really good training program where you're exposed to lots of different things, just so that they can make sure that you're getting the experience that you need so that when you do qualify, you are well equipped.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So that's really good to hopefully that's broken it down for our listeners. What about the changes then? So Jessica, we're really keen to speak to you about the changes that are taking place in how people will train to be a lawyer from this point on if they're interested in a career in being a solicitor.
Okay, so the Solicitors Regulation Authority has, as of September, introduced a new route to qualify as a solicitor. So where previously you would have had to do a degree and a practice course and then your 2 year training contract, it now just has four very distinct requirements. So those are, number one, a degree in any subject, so whether that's law or any other degree that you would choose to study. Two, passing two exams, which are now known as the Solicitors Qualifications Examinations. They are written by the SRA and they are standardised across the board, so everyone will be sitting exactly the same exams. And then number three, you still need 2 years of qualifying work experience, but it's now much more flexible in that you don't have to do it with one law firm. You can do it in up to four different organisations, and it doesn't have to be a specific training contract format. It can be paralegal experience, time spent advising in student law clinics when you're at university, volunteering at a law centre or a sort of citizens advice bureau, and also any placements that you do within your degree are also relevant. So that 2 years of work experience is much more flexible now than doing your specific 2 years employed with a law firm. And that's the main change of this new route.
And Jessica, personally, what do you think about it?
I think it's good because it obviously means that everyone who is being admitted as a solicitor is being assessed sort of consistently. And because the exams are standardised, everyone is going to have the same sort of baseline knowledge. I think that's really good. I also think it opens up the profession to people that may not have considered it previously, because there's this new way of gaining work experience, and training contracts are notoriously difficult to obtain and they're very competitive. And I think now that this 2 years isn't making applications to specific firms for a job for 2 years, and people have the flexibility to gain experience in different areas and don't need to necessarily get that 2 year employment contract as they would have had to do prior to this September. So I think it's just basically opening up the profession, which is positive.
It does indeed sound positive. And I think that'll be great news for parents, because I think so many parents want their children to go down the law route. You know, it's such a great profession. It's solid. It's, you know, it's very prestigious. So it's great news that actually what you do at degree level or even immediately after degree level doesn't define your professional path for good. So that's really, really good news for parents out there. And Why do you think they made the changes, or why do you think they were needed?
I think the length of time to qualify as a solicitor, it, like I said, it's years and years of education and then years of experience on top of that. And it's really difficult to do your training contract at the same time as you're in education, because the studying just takes up so much time and obviously brain power. So I think it's reducing the length of overall time, but it's also this standardisation. So the SRA now are in charge of the exams and what standard people need to be at to qualify, whereas before the exams were run by individual universities and other education establishments, and they were sort of setting their own bar. So now I think everyone will be at a specific level, which is a good baseline for everyone to start at.
I mean, I love the idea that they've opened the profession up. I love the idea that there are different routes now in. I know that some of the larger firms are offering legal apprenticeships so that young people can even access this over a much longer period, obviously, but after they've done their A-levels directly, because they might not be able to afford to go to university. I mean, I think these are great things in a profession that has really been very traditional in my own experience, but also been seen to be very traditional and rigid. Yeah. So I'm really glad. And one thing I think we are coming to the end of the interview, but I'd just like you to clarify for our listeners, is that what we're talking about today is progressing to being a solicitor, but that's different from being a barrister. And actually, very simply and briefly, could you explain the difference between a barrister and a solicitor for our listeners, please?
Yeah, so both solicitors and barristers are sort of under the umbrella of a lawyer. And I get a lot of questions asking what's the difference between a lawyer and a solicitor and a barrister. So both solicitors and barristers are technically lawyers, but they are very different professions and they require very different training. So a solicitor is the person that has day-to-day conduct of a file, dealing with a client day-to-day, answering queries, preparing documents for them, preparing for court hearings, and very much the client's port of call. Barristers are generally instructed by solicitors to do the advocacy work. So that's representing a client in court. And they're the ones that stand on their feet and talk to judge and put a client's position and case across to a judge in court, and also provide specialist advice because they are experts in their field. So that's they are very different professions. And in summary, a solicitor works with a client on a day-to-day basis and has more involvement and sort of knows the client better. Barristers will pick up cases, different cases each day, but they're the ones that are in court and acting on behalf of clients when they're in court and putting their case across.
That's great. I think it's great to hear that. I think for my age parent, you know, it's watching LA Law and Ally McBeal and things like that, where the lawyers there, they just do everything. So, you know, and they're called lawyers, of course. And so we don't quite distinguish between the solicitors, who are more client-based, and actually the barristers, who are the ones who are generally donning the wigs and going into court. So that is great to have that. And really, I think it's great that you've been able to explain that quite simply to our parents. And it's been absolutely lovely to speak with you today, Jessica. So thank you very much for joining us on the Parent Show this evening. And best of luck with your career in law.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Hello and welcome to the Parents Show on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. I'm Lydia El-Khoury. And in this section of tonight's show, we have a really interesting project that we want to tell all you parents out there about. And it's called the Politics Project. And in the studio with me, I have Rosa Slater, who is the project coordinator, program coordinator indeed, for the Politics Project, joining with me. Hi, Rosa.
Hi, Lydia. It's great to be with you today.
Lovely to have you on the Parents Show. So tell us the Politics Project. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So at the Politics Project, we specialise in engagements between young people and politicians. So we're a non-partisan organisation, meaning that we engage with all politicians here in the UK, regardless of their political party. And we work across the UK to connect young people with their representatives. So we've been doing this since 2015, and we have delivered hundreds of these types of engagements over that time. And the interesting thing is that they're actually all virtual, and they already were before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, we were actually in a great position to continue our work, which was really good. But we have been connecting, young people and politicians for quite a few years now, and learned a lot of different things about young people, and also just the best ways to engage with those who have political power.
Fantastic. I absolutely love the sound of the project, and I think it's great to get children engaged with politics. Can you tell us why it was set up, how it got set up?
Yeah, sure. So our director and our founder is called Hattie Andrews, and she saw that there was an opportunity to reimagine the way that politicians visit schools. So this is because around 5% of schools in the UK engage with their local politicians. And that is a very, very small number. And when the politician does go in and visit the students, sometimes this can be really effective and really great, but sometimes it can be quite rushed. There's a lot of different students to see. Sometimes it can become a bit like having a little local celebrity, and it doesn't have that much in terms of actually being able to engage really constructively about local issues. So in order to get young people to engage in democracy more by having their political representatives come in to school, it means that they can feel more part of the system. And a big problem has been not having trust between young people and their representatives. This is at an all-time low at the moment. And so for us to be able to facilitate these conversations that make young people realise that politicians are, you know, normal people like themselves, and for politicians to realise that young people do have a lot of ideas and things to contribute to democracy, yeah, this could be a really positive thing.
It sounds very positive indeed, and I love the idea of giving young people access to democracy, really in practice, and to real life people who are representing them. It's a fabulous idea. And I was going to ask you that actually, about whether COVID has helped you or not, but you were up and running and ready to go even when COVID hit.
Yeah, I guess one main issue we had was that schools were closed. And so we ran some of them remotely completely, but that is a bit more difficult because then the teacher isn't there directly with students, getting them to be involved. And also, I mean, teachers have had a really difficult time the last couple of years, so they've been really busy. So sometimes being able to recruit people to take part has been a challenge. But yeah, everyone that we've worked with has been amazing, really.
Brilliant. So talk to us about the kind of activities you do.
So the main work that we do is run through our digital surgeries program. So this is the concept of a digital surgery. So surgery where a politician meets with their constituents, and it is essentially where the politician will speak to the young people, but the young people will speak to the politician. And the unique thing about this is that it can be in a quite informal setting. So students prepare their questions beforehand and decide this together, but this isn't shared with the politician beforehand. So it means that it can be a very candid conversation, and there's also questions that the politician will decide to ask the students. And it just means that it's very conversational, and also that the politician hears from students what it is that they care about. And we have a whole range of teaching resources that teachers use to make little workshops before the students meet with the politician. So that means that they can get full context. Okay, let's research who's the person I'm meeting. Okay, how is it that we can ask a good question? What makes an effective question? And just more general understanding of the structure of government, local government, because a lot of people aren't taught this in school. So yeah, it's really positive. And that means that with that background, the students can be a lot more engaged and interested in meeting them.
Brilliant. No, it's a fantastic idea. And I actually, from what you're saying, I can imagine teaching them how to learn, ask questions properly is also teaching them how to think critically and to kind of evaluate what's being said and understand the semantics and politics in general. I think it's a really great idea. So what age group are we talking about?
Oh, so we do work with primary schools. We work with year 5 and 6 in primary school, so that the older students, we have specific resources that are suitable for them. And then we also work with the entirety of secondary school and sixth form. So as you can imagine, digital surgery that I'm in with year five or year six is very different to one with sixth formers. But it's really interesting, yeah, to see the things that all young, well, not all young people, but you see similar themes coming through. You know, young people care a lot about the environment. They care a lot about mental health. And you can see that from a child aged 10 to aged 18. But it's really exciting to be able to engage with such a different range of young people from all different backgrounds.
That is quite a broad range. And would they participate in as a year or as a class, or how does it work, or does it vary?
So we tend to try and have these sessions be quite small, because it just means that it keeps the informal element, like I spoke about, where most young people who are taking part are able to ask a question. So we aim to have around 30 students take part in one digital surgery. And yeah, that is really effective because most people feel like they are involved. But I mean, yeah, it's really nice. Like, there's some fun questions that come out of it. We, you know, we'll have a year six child that will ask, when do you think robots are going to take over the world? So there's like really lovely bits. But I think, yeah, there are a lot of range of young people that take part, and it's really nice.
I really like that the politicians don't get the questions in advance. That's good. If you don't want to be given any heads up.
Yeah, not trying to trip anyone up, but it's just really nice because the students understand a bit more what makes an effective question. We have a little flow chart, you know, can you Google it? If you can just Google it, there's no point asking it. So yeah. It makes it, yeah, young people really think about what is something really interesting, and people get really creative with it. It's really fun.
Great stuff. And so if you're a parent and you're listening in and this sounds like something you think would really resonate with your child or young person, what's the process? How does it work in terms of implementation?
So all our opportunities are done through schools. So we work with schools directly because we train teachers to use our resources and to take part in the digital surgeries program. But if you're a parent and you're listening in and you think this sounds really interesting, then feel free to spread the word about us. You could speak to your children's school about them joining the programme. Our initial programme is free of charge, so it should be of interest to a lot of different people. And if you are a teacher, you can attend training yourself, take part. Or if you know any teachers, then feel free to spread the word about the Politics Project. You can follow our social media as well. We're at Politics Project on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, so you can stay up to date with what we're doing.
Fantastic. And I'm sure they'll be able to get contact details through your socials as well. Actually, you've got a great website too.
Yeah, we've got a brand new website, which is really exciting. It only launched last month, so feel free to have a look. It's thepoliticsproject.org.uk.
Nice and simple. Brilliant. Rosa, thanks so much for joining us on The Parents Show. It was really interesting. Keep up the great work.
Oh, thank you so much, Lydia. Yeah, it's been really nice to be here today.